This episode is brought to you by Kia's first three-row, all-electric SUV, the Kia EV9. With available all-wheel drive and seating for up to seven adults. With 0-60 speed that thrills you 1 minute and available lounge seats that unwind you the next. Visit kia.com/EV9 to learn more. Ask your Kia dealer for availability. No system, no matter how advanced, can compensate for all driver error and or driving conditions. Always drive safely.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, Brian Kilmeade here, back with you on a rainy Thursday right in New York City. But we're heard around the world. We really are. We get calls from everywhere. Dave McCormick's going to be on this hour. It's going to be great. He's a Republican U.S. Senate candidate. He's got that nomination. He's going to take on Bob Casey. You know, he almost got the nomination from Dr. Oz this time, and we know what happened there with Fetterman prevailing. Right now he's trailing, but we'll see if he can make some ground up, as Dave McCormick gets pretty well known. His resume is quite impressive. And we are following the President of the United States. He's going to be coming to New York City. He's got a major fundraiser today with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Right now, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
For the past 3 years, I have led our administration's efforts to address the root causes of migration. This work is improving lives and livelihoods in the region and addressing the factors that drive people to migrate to the United States.
Yeah, the border czar Harris pathetically takes a bow for attacking root causes of the immigration crisis. Once again, a South American nation breaching our border taunts the administration. We bring you the latest from the chaos at our southern border, which is wreaking havoc in our cities.
Number two.
Here in North Carolina, even 45% of Democrats are concerned about Biden's mental state. She somewhat dismissed that. And then I just said, okay, well, does he have dementia? And I was surprised that she was so offended.
She was. That's Mark Garrison, North Carolina radio station WBT. 2024, poor poll numbers, listless rallies interrupted by protesters. Has the Biden team reaching into the past for help? Clinton and Obama summoned to Radio City for a star-studded fundraiser. Will that make a difference?
Number one.
It's directed at the city council, who seems to believe that criminals in today's day and age should be considered to be the victims of crimes. They're not doing the work of the people, which is what they were voted in to do.
Stay home. That's the message from the police union's head to lawmakers who have been anti-cop when it comes to showing up for the wake of Officer Jonathan Diller, gunned down in Queens by a career criminal, as President Trump plans to attend this service for the 31-year-old who has left a young wife and a 1-year-old behind. And that is the number one story in the country. Dave Portnoy of Barstool, able to raise $1.4 million, tunneled to towers, taking care of the mortgage. Uncle Giuseppe's just wrote me. They are a major supermarket in the Northeast. They're going to take care of her groceries for a year. They just want to get a hold of her and make her that offer. The GoFundMe page has money flowing in, but this is the best you could do for a terrible situation. Jonathan Diller on a routine traffic stop, what everyone tells you is not routine, now we know for sure, pulled over. The guy that was stopped in the bus lane ends up shooting Jonathan Diller. The video shows he gets to the back of his car, pulls himself there, was able to try to protect his partner who took out the guy and captured the other one. Both had long rap sheets. Donald Trump called the family, got the widow on the phone, and they said, if we'd like to invite you to the funeral or the wake. And he said, great, I'll be at the wake. And he's going to fly in from Florida. And the President of the United States, I mean, who's in his communications team? Or why doesn't he take control? I don't think anyone to tell Donald Trump to call the widow. So President Biden is coming to New York City, is across the street from us at Radio City with Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Lizzo, who hates Israel, and Stephen Colbert, who hates Republicans, and some B-list celebrities. They're going to get a ton of money, $25 million, great. But if you did want to do that, that's fine. But why not go to Long Island first? Why not go to the subway station where some psycho just threw a New Yorker onto the subway tracks, timed perfectly, where he got crushed instantly and lost his life? He chooses not to do these things. And people are fed up, I think, because I don't think Democrats or Republicans, I think everybody wants to be safe on city streets. I know Chicago, I know Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Austin, Texas. These places are like the Wild West in the Northeast. Here's Vincent Vallelong. Now, Vincent is the president of the SBA, the Sergeants Benevolent Association. And he made it clear, there are so many people on the city council, there's so many people in Albany, New York, that, and like maybe your city and your state, that are criminal first, bail reform, make it impossible to jail any nonviolent, even felon, while they wait for trial. Cut one.
It's directed at the city council, who seems to believe that criminals in today's day and age should be considered to be the victims of crimes, and that the police department and the police officers that come and give their lives day in and day out, they're the ones who are the villains in this story. They're not doing the work of the people, which is what they were voted in to do.
Yeah.
You know, they have their own agenda. They don't look at these stats. They think that their way is the right way, and they double down on it.
And he's saying stay home. And he's talking about people like city council speaker, probably means nothing to you, but just know this name. Adrian Adams hates cops. Public advocate Jumaine Williams thinks every cop's a racist. And you just stay away. So don't sit there because you're trying to get keep your seat, show up on Long Island. Now, Mayor Adams, whatever you want to say about him, he's not anti-cop. He may not be the perfect mayor, and his approval ratings show that no one thinks he's close to that. He's actually below where de Blasio was. But he's been saying that this is impossible to keep law and order in the streets. Cut three.
You do an analysis of all of these reporting that you're doing, and you're going to keep coming up with the same three items. Severe mental health, random act of violence, recidivism, over and over again. And what's interesting is that our practices, laws, and policies are not going after those three issues.
They're not. City council doesn't care. I'm not for, you know, everybody wants to police, you know, you can do bail reform, you can do police reform. I know on theory, if you say to yourself, well, you know, why is it that such and such person, Bill Jones, who's a billionaire, can commit a crime and get out in bail, and you set the same bail for a working class person who's a suspect until he goes to trial or she? Why do they sit in jail? Because they can't make bond. Well, in theory, that's fine. But when you see what these guys are doing, knocking off CVSs, walking into stores, taking everything from Kohl's and walking out with it because it's nonviolent, if they're caught, they're let out right away. And because you got these lenient judges in these liberal cities, they'll let them walk. So everyone's paying a price for that. So these stores that stay around, they got to up the prices because everyone's stealing stuff. Or you got to lock everything behind screens like you used to. Just remember how annoying it was with razors? Oh, I got to get a guy with the keys to open up so I can get a razor. Now, it's all stores are like that. Here's more from Mayor Eric Adams, cut four.
And the second issue that we have in this city is a severe mental health illness problem that was played out on 125th Street and Lexington Avenue at the subway station. And he was a recidivist. Several severe mental health issues, indicators of violence. 50% of the people at Rikers Island are dealing with mental health issues, and 18% are severe. And then you add the random acts of violence to that. All of them played out last night.
So I'll put some names to this. The lunatic, and he is a lunatic, Carlton McPherson, whose family said the city let him down. We try to get him help, but no one will take him. They keep letting him out. So he gets off his train, I think 161st Street, and walks out and tries to line somebody up perfectly timed with the train and throw them to their death. Sadly, he finds that person. And that person is Sammy Sanchez. Sammy Sanchez is 54 years old. Judging by what these people are saying, he's a happy-go-lucky guy, never had a bad day in his life. And you see his picture in the New York Post. He just happened to be waiting for a subway. That's what he's guilty of. And then you got this TikTok video. I hate TikTok, but they got this video out that caught my attention. All women speaking on camera, battered and bruised, who are randomly punched on streets. And I know, we know this is happening. So this is what's going on. And this is not, if it was just a New York story, I'd save it for a different hour where we get more New York affiliates in. But this is a American story because there's no fear of going to prison. The numbers are the show that things are getting better. You know, it's so interesting. The numbers say that violent crime has gone down and robberies have gone down. Carjacking has gone up in different areas. So the president of the United States saying crime is going in the right direction. All right. That's another thing, like the economy. The numbers may look good, but it doesn't feel right. And you're not in the subway, Mr. President. You are very well protected. You have a chance to go to the subway today, though, by the way, but you're not. All right, so listen, we have a lot to discuss. I'll be able to take some calls just around the bend, or you can write me. Go to briankilmeade.com, click on comments, and it'll come right to my email. So I look forward to getting that. And you can do that right now, or you can call 1-866-408-7669. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Shipping can make or break a sale, so optimize how you ship your orders with ShipStation. They make it easy to automate and manage orders no matter how big your business grows. And they might even be able to help reduce shipping and warehouse costs. So optimize and keep up your momentum for growth with ShipStation. Sign up for your free 60-day trial now at ShipStation.com and use the code POD. That's ShipStation.com with the code POD.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Senator, who do you want to see win?
That's a tough one. Look, I agree with a lot of what President Trump has done, particularly on foreign and defense policy, really. Particularly Iran, the whole Middle East, China, et cetera. But, you know, I know Biden for a long time. I like him, so I'm sort of inclined in his direction, really.
Let me just say, Joe Lieberman passing at the age of 82 years old is just so sad. Fantastic guy. Never had a bad day. Never saw him without a smile. I saw him when he was a candidate. Got to know him a little as a senator. When he was a candidate, totally approachable. And then after he had somewhat of a rift with the Democratic Party and they decided to run Ned Lamont against him, he goes, all right, you could take Ned Lamont. I'm going to go independent. And he goes independent and beats everybody. And then goes back to the Senate as an independent. But they wouldn't take him on because they couldn't lose the seat. So he says, I'll caucus with Democrats. And that's fine. They made him a chairman. But he traveled the country with Lindsey Graham and John McCain, and they really made a difference on foreign policy. Just fantastic. In fact, John McCain regrets not running with him and took Sarah Palin instead. Nothing against Sarah Palin. Is that people thought that as a Democrat, technically a Democrat, that John McCain would lose so many Republican supporters that he shouldn't do it. So he took a risk, and the risk did not work out. But Joe Lieberman has to be one of my best guests. When I see him on my guest sheet, I always thought to myself, this is going to be interesting because he doesn't care about party. He cared about country. And he started No Labels because of that. And this No Labels, whatever you want to say about it, it's the most formidable group that we've seen as a third party. It was first a show on Sirius. Here's more from Joe Lieberman, who was on our show. Allison, how would you time? Would you say 25 times? Maybe
so
more?
Often, never enough.
Yeah. About 25 times. He'd always come on when he could. Cut 35. Senator, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, thank you. You're one of my favorites, and I would say America's favorites, too.
Well, you're way too nice, but I tell you, I learned more foreign policy from you, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, because you guys go out and see it. You don't say, well, this seems to be the way they're debating it at War College, and this seems to be where it goes at the Foreign Affairs Council. You go and meet the players over the last 30, 40 years.
First off, I just, in passing, want to say you're absolutely right about John McCain and Lindsey Graham and me. Dave Petraeus, General Petraeus, after about our seventh or eighth visit to him in Afghanistan or Iraq, dubbed us the Three Amigos. I mean, we just decided we got a responsibility as senators to make important national policy. You can't do it in your office back in Washington alone or talking to the Washington think tankers. You got to go out. And We did, and we learned a lot. And I'll tell you what else happened, which doesn't happen enough in Washington today. You know, you travel for hours on a plane, you talk to each other, you laugh with each other, and you become friends, and you trust each other. And so even if you disagree,
yeah,
on, you still work together.
Yeah, just the greatest guy. And I'll tell you what, I think he was getting a serious look at Secretary of Defense after Mattis left. So I know Trump really liked him, and they hit it off. I appreciate guys like that. Okay, Trump's a different personality. Joe Biden's not the same guy. He tried to be delicate about that, but he was saying the same thing. Here's an example of why I know I'm not ageist, because Mick Jagger's the same age as Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman could be president. Joe Biden has lost his fastball. It's not because he's 80. It's because how he lived his life and maybe some physical things he had to deal with. So that's a big difference. This guy could still be president. He just chose to be a professor and be a policy guy and then start a, in the last lap of his life, start a great organization like No Labels, sadly, who won't get a chance to see if they play a role in this cycle. Let's go to the phones. Brian, listen on WHLO over at 640 AM. Hey, Brian.
Hello.
Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
I was calling in on about the border. Obviously, what's going on down there. But I was listening to your show earlier talking about the police officer. You know, the Republicans have got to get a clearer message. And I don't know whether it's stop talking about, you know, Republican and independent Democrat and got to start talking about we the people. It's like, hopefully all the people who love this country, we got to start getting a message across that we're losing this country with what's going on. Joe Biden's incompetent. We had this horrific legal immigrant rape girl in Boston. And if they've tied that to him and his administration flying illegals in and knew this guy was a criminal, how is he not complicit in what's going on? I just don't understand this. I mean, he violated our Constitution.
Hey, Brian, I don't even care if he knew about his background. These guys shouldn't be here. They should not be flying in on our dollar in the middle of the night. And if they were so proud of it, it would be in the middle of the day. And they would announce it. But they know they got to sneak him in because it's so abhorrent. And the things you just asked for should not be a partisan issue. Enforcing our border and bringing some calm to our streets, enforcing the law. These are easy things for every American. The problem is we've lost total logic. He lets the border break. He allows people to pour in. And then he goes, well, it's not really not my problem. There was legislation and Republicans didn't sign off on it. Everybody knows he doesn't care about the border. He's only visited twice his entire career. And he made a total political speech. Doesn't even know what the issues are. His vice president admitted yesterday that she was in charge of the root causes of immigration. First, she was denying it. She's done nothing on it except to get some private investment in some South American countries. Some investment. But they need long-term. If you want to help out, you teach them industries, you don't give them aid. In the short term, you don't give them aid until they control their own border and live their life and control their country. So here is Kamala Harris. I hate to even roll this in, but here's the president of Guatemala, cut 22.
What we are trying to say is fundamentally about cooperation is not sending money. Cooperation can be by creating conditions in which we can invite you to invest in Guatemala and establish factories, works that can begin to produce and create jobs. That's fundamentally what we are most interested in. And we believe our country do presents
right.
Huge opportunities for investment.
And we want to get the manufacturing out of China, and we want to make the industry, put the industries into our hemisphere. We'd love to be able to write checks to Guatemala instead to China. We'd love to start bringing some of our industries down to Guatemala. For Nicaragua to be communist, it'll never happen, but El Salvador and Mexico, which we've done a lot. See, we could do that. That should have been our focus. But in the meantime, you have to threaten them to keep people in their own countries. Just say, listen, nothing happens if you don't control your border. Got it? Nothing. Dave McCormick next.
radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Last night, our current Senator Bob Casey attended an event with an anti-police organization, Indivisible Philadelphia. Subsequent to that event last night, Indivisible Pennsylvania has announced that they are endorsing Senator Bob Casey in his run to be the Senator of Pennsylvania. This is a group that said, we won't stop until they defund the police. They have called for fewer officers on the street. They have advocated to end cash bail. This is a group that is responsible for bailing out some of the most violent offenders that Pennsylvania has to offer. At a time when there were 4 shootings in 4 days on our local public transit system and law enforcement across the Commonwealth is understaffed, Casey's decision to align himself with these defund the police activists is alarming and extremely dangerous.
But he's cocky. He thinks there's nobody's going to beat me. My dad had this job for a long time. I've had this job forever. I don't really do much in Congress. You have no idea where I vote. I pretend to people that I'm moderate, but when's the last time you saw him and Joe Manchin in cinema come together to push back on any of the craziness of adding 2 states or getting rid of the filibuster, some of the nutty things that have come out of this Senate? That hasn't happened. That's why Dave McCormick is giving it a shot. He's going to try to unseat Bob Casey as the next senator in Pennsylvania in November's election. Dave McCormick joins us now. Dave, that must have felt good to get that endorsement.
Oh, felt great to get the endorsement of 47 sheriffs and the Delaware FOP. And I think law enforcement across Pennsylvania is going to get behind me. And the reason for that is Bob Casey's been terrible on law and order. You know, this Indivisible Philadelphia thing where he's gladly taken the endorsement of a defund the police organization. But beyond that, Bob's been terrible on law and order. He's supported Larry Krasner, the liberal prosecutor in Philadelphia, who's put in place a rule where if you steal less than $1,000, you're not prosecuted. Casey's been for sanctuary cities. He's been against Kate's Law, which would have set a mandatory imprisonment minimum for deported felons. He's said that the problem is systemic racism in our police departments. And what we have in Pennsylvania is a law and order crisis. We can't get enough policemen in Pittsburgh, where I live. There were 1,000 police officers in 2020. There's 650 now. My neighborhood in Squirrel Hill in the city, you know, we used to have 6 cars patrolling at night. Now we have 2 or 3. It's a real crisis. And Bob Casey's culpable. And I'm going to hold him accountable for that and a whole set of other policies, whether it's sky-high inflation or the war on energy or the unbelievably challenge that we face on the border, because Bob Casey's been at the scene of the crime in every one of these terrible policy choices.
So, Dave, what could you do? Let's say you do beat him and you, law enforcement is a priority, which I know it is with you. What could you do as a senator?
Well, the first thing you want to do is you want to be a voice that stands behind folks in uniform. I wore the uniform myself in the military. But we got to make sure that our law enforcement agencies have the respect and the budget necessary. And, yes, those local budgets are part of what drives it. But having leadership up front that says law and order is critical. The second thing is qualified immunity. So making sure that our police officers aren't susceptible to constant legal action taken against them for doing their job. The third thing is the border crisis. You know, that's putting a huge burden on law enforcement and the fentanyl that's coming across our border. We lost 5,000 people in Pennsylvania last year from that fentanyl. That makes the job of police officers much more dangerous. These gangs that and cartels that are in coordination with the gangs across our country, make law enforcement a much more difficult job. So those are three things that you could do on day one to give much more support to our law enforcement officers.
So that would certainly help. The other thing that I don't hear talked about enough is when the President of the United States decides arbitrarily to stop all new leases on natural gas drilling or fracking, and they say, we have enough out there. That affects people of Pennsylvania. Can you explain why?
Oh, man, Brian, this is the amazing thing about it. So what the Biden administration has essentially done is it's laid out a vision for eliminating fossil fuels. And that's been terrible for America. It's been terrible for our national security, because by exporting our fossil fuels, particularly natural gas, that's a source of strength for us. It makes our allies less dependent on places like Russia. It hurts our economy because those are great jobs. Those natural gas drilling operations in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, by the way, has the fourth largest natural gas reserves in the world. If it were a country, it'd be the fourth largest. It's amazing. And we just can't get that natural gas out of the ground because of the restrictions that the Biden administration and previous administrations, the Obama administration, has put on drilling. But it's also getting pipelines that can get the gas to other states and an offshore port that can send it abroad. So it's terrible economically. But here's the irony. It's terrible for the environment, because by exporting natural gas, we replace coal-fired plants in India and China, which are the big driver of carbon emissions. So the Biden administration is – the irony is they've made things worse for everybody. And if you could do one thing for Pennsylvania, Brian, if you had a magic wand, the one thing that would change the trajectory of our economy and opportunity for our young people in Pennsylvania, it would be unlock natural gas.
But, Dean, not only that, if you want – Eastern Europe to get off natural gas from Russia, like Lithuania, why would you stop producing natural gas? And don't tell me we had enough.
Yeah, it's absolutely so stupid. And when they say that exports are up, that's true. Exports are up, but they're a fraction of what they could be if we made ourselves an energy superpower. And here's the thing, Brian, that I just want to highlight, and I think it will be the greatest strategic miscalculation of the Biden administration. By essentially trying to retool our entire economy and make it more dependent on electric vehicles and solar and wind, we have made ourselves much more dependent on China.
I know.
So that energy policy has driven up our inflation dramatically, and all the spending's driven up our inflation. But the lithium batteries that we're now dependent on, the solar panels we're now dependent on, come from China. So at a time when China is our biggest adversary, at a time during COVID where we learned we don't want to be dependent on semiconductors or pharmaceuticals from China, we made ourselves more dependent on China because of the crazy energy policies of the Biden administration. And we're going to look back on that someday, and we're going to say, what a horrible mistake.
I think we should say, I don't know if they're in Pennsylvania. It just seems terrible for the country and for Pennsylvania. Yeah. But is there a portion of Pennsylvania, the state is so huge, that is happy about this, that is going to counter it? You know, sometimes you have a split personality. So the state, you look at Philadelphia, their goals are much different than different portions of the country. Is there a clamor in Philadelphia to stop drilling?
My impression of going, we have 67 counties. I've spent time in all of them. People want a vibrant economy in Pennsylvania. Of course, there's a radical environmental group orientation, which basically says eliminate fossil fuels. But that's a small minority. Most Pennsylvanians want a great economy, great paying jobs, and they want a clean environment. That's where I am, by the way. This isn't zero sum. It's not like you can have a great, vibrant energy economy and not have a clean environment. You can have both. And the great irony is that natural gas is a great source of clean energy that will replace carbon emissions around the world. And the other thing, we're very dependent in Pennsylvania on nuclear. And we need to unlock the potential of nuclear. And the thing that's standing in the way, the technology has become so much more smaller, more compact, safer, environmentally safe. Nuclear energy is a key part of our future, but we have to have regulations that allow us to have investment and deploy the next generation of nuclear reactors. We don't have that either, because we don't have the deregulation necessary in the Biden administration. So listen, I'm for all energy sources, but I'm also for market-driven energy sources. You put trillions of dollars on EVs and solar panels, you're going to distort the economy, drive up inflation, and kill our industry in Pennsylvania, which is a terrible mistake.
So, Dave, you leave, I think it's Bridgewater, right? And you decide to run for office, and you go against a really tough opponent, Dr. Oz, and he gets the nomination but loses to Fetterman. What did you learn during that first stint?
Well, I lost that vote by 900. I lost that primary by 900 votes of 1.5 million cast. So that's a gut check. And you basically say, hey, why am I doing this? And do I want to do this again? And I thought hard about not doing it. The reason I'm doing it is because I think the country is headed in a terrible direction, and 80% of Pennsylvanians agree with me. And so if you believe in America, if you believe America's in trouble, and you believe you can do something about it, you know, I'm called to do that. I'm called to service, which is what my life's been about, West Point and military and serving in the government. I've always been about service. And what I learned, I think the most important thing is, you know, go and lay out your agenda, lay out your leadership, and be your authentic self. People in Pennsylvania want leadership. They're terrified that their kids are going to be less well off than they are. And they don't want somebody they're going to agree with 100% of the time. That's not nobody. I mean, I don't agree with my wife 100% of the time. I'm lucky if I'm at 80% of the time, right? So they want somebody who's gonna fight for them.
Yep.
Who is a leader and is gonna stand up for what they believe in. And that's the opposite of Bob Casey. This is a guy. My mom's from Punxsutawney, and I like to say about Casey, he's like Punxsutawney Phil, but he comes out every 6 years for his election, but he's not leading. And we need leaders right now, leaders of conviction, leaders who want to serve our great Commonwealth and our great country. And that's the argument I'm making to the people of Pennsylvania. I believe I'm going to win this race, and I believe I'm going to win it right, because it's a change election. And it's a tough time for incumbents to defend the terrible direction of our country, particularly an incumbent like Bob Casey, who's voted with Biden 98% of the time. And so that's what I've learned, and that's the campaign I'm running.
So it looks like the last poll that I see is the Hill Emerson on the between the 310 and 313 of this month has you trailing by 4. Susquehanna had you down by 6 on the 5th of March. So we'll see. You got plenty of time to close that gap. I also
the big thing, Brian, is just getting people to know me. You know, Bob
absolutely.
Casey's been around for 30 years, and about half of Pennsylvania knows me. The half that vote knows me wants to vote for me in the majority, and that's the case I'm making. By the way, I'm traveling around the Commonwealth in my bus, visiting small towns every county, and I think that's the path to victory.
So Dave McCormick is with us, and I think has the president endorsed you, former president?
The president has not endorsed me. I've received the nomination. And cleared the field without any endorsements other than Republicans across Pennsylvania, which was great. And I've endorsed President Trump. I had said from the beginning that if whoever our nominee was, I'd endorse our nominee. President Trump was Mehmet Oz in the last race. And my view is that we now have a united ticket in Pennsylvania, and that President Trump being on the ballot helps me. And I believe me being on the ballot helps him, and I hope we'll both find victory.
And you're from big business. Part of your background is at Bridgewater. You were there, and now you want to go back into service. You were at West Point, where you wrestled. When the president of the United States being called out for his business practices, and now you see the ridiculous $175 million bond, and the fact is there was no one hurt. This is Letitia James targeting him. The bigger question was, what is the message to the business community? Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank said this.
What are we doing, let alone New York? You don't want to put anything here till this actually settles down. And what people are looking for in institutional capital, where I work, and we're all talking to each other every day, they're saying to each other, when are the adults coming? Mm-hmm. When will there be adult supervision in this case? Because these kids have gone crazy at night at a party with no parents around. Mm-hmm. And they're hurting everything that makes this country great, if you're an entrepreneur. I mean, it's just unprecedented. I mean, it's just crazy. And it's got to stop, because if I were in the White House, this may sound absolutely nuts, I would intervene and say, okay, that's enough. We're telling people all around the world, don't bring your money here, because we're just crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's bad.
You're obviously a Republican. You're a conservative. If you have money and the firm that you were with invests everywhere, are you leery about New York?
I'm terribly, I think what's happened under President Biden is, and this is a big thing to say, I think it's the most anti-business administration we've had in modern history. And I don't just mean for big business, I mean for business, small business too. The amount of regulatory regulation and regulatory overreach that we've seen from the SEC and from others, everywhere I go in Pennsylvania, I hear about the regulations becoming much more burdensome. And the two-tier justice system, where you see a clear political agenda on behalf of New York, but also across the country, in terms of how President Trump's being treated in the judicial system, it's clear that he wouldn't be treated that way if it weren't for his political leadership. And so I think it's very worrisome, because that's the one right. thing that America always stood out for in the world, was that it was a business environment which would be allow free enterprise, and where the judicial system would allow a fair shot and appropriate remediation of business claims. This is very dangerous, and yeah. I think the world's watching. And I think as a business guy, and it's not a big business guy; it's a business guy. I ran a small firm which became a big firm in Pittsburgh, which created hundreds of jobs, and then I was the CEO of Bridgewater. Small businesses drive 80% of the jobs in America and in Pennsylvania, and this administration's bad for all business, including small businesses, which are the heart and soul of America.
All right, Dave McCormick, thanks so much. Appreciate it. He's got the military background, graduate West Point, fantastic wrestler, captain of the team, made his money in international business and a small business, you just heard, and now he wants to go and bring all that to Pennsylvania. I can't wait to see when Bob Casey realizes what he's dealing with. I'm not sure he realizes yet, Dave.
Can I tell your listeners that if they want to learn more about me, it's at DaveMcCormickPA.com.
Gotcha.
And I'm always honored to be on your show. Thank you.
Go get him, Dave. Thanks so much. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Just a quick note on the 27th. It's coming up next month, April 27th. I'm going to be in Henderson, Nevada, just outside Las Vegas. It's going to be history, liberty, and laughs. Going to be on stage reenacting in a fun way. Great moments in our past, building off the books that most of you have bought, and I appreciate if anybody wants it, BrianKilmeade.com. Which you'd also could get tickets. So I hope to see everybody out there. They're selling well. VIP opportunities are really cool. You get there an hour before, a little bit earlier, and I have a chance to talk to you, sign your books, take pictures. But we'll talk about anything on your mind, whether it's the news, whether it's history, whether it's the election, whether it's the economy, the border, whatever's on your mind. And then you tell me what's going on in Henderson, because a lot of people, the best thing is a lot of people from the area get to tell me what their life is like. Not what people say it's like with unemployment, with GDP, with growth, whatever. Right now, Nevada is in the former president's column by 2 points. I don't remember him ever leading in Nevada. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, where diagonally from where I'm at right now, three presidents will gather. It's historic. President Biden, President Obama, President Clinton, and they'll have to make about $25 million in funds. So Stephen Colbert will moderate, and everyone will talk about how bad Donald Trump is. I got it. I understand it. It will not affect the election. Money won't decide it. You know, anytime former presidents get together, I know George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush talked about this. Very few people hold these jobs to see presidents in one place at one time. I know it meant a lot to 43 when Barack Obama got elected to have his dad and Bill Clinton there and Jimmy Carter there at the same time. So that's historic. But we have more to this story, and the president's going to be coming to New York shortly. But let's get to the big three, and then we're going to get to Mark Thiessen.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
For the past 3 years, I have led our administration's efforts to address the root causes of migration. This work is improving lives and livelihoods in the region and addressing the factors that drive people to migrate to the United States.
Yeah, borders are Paris. Pathetically takes a bow for attacking root causes of the border crisis. Really? Once again, a South American nation breaching our borders taunts the administration. We bring you the, with demands, by the way, we bring you the latest.
Number two.
Here in North Carolina, even 45% of Democrats are concerned about Biden's mental state. She somewhat dismissed that. And then I just said, okay, well, does he have dementia? And I was surprised that she was so offended.
Yeah, 45% of Democrats are concerned with the president's mental state. That's a fact. I think it's even higher for the rest of the country, obviously. 2024, poor poll numbers, listless rallies, interrupted by protesters, has the Biden team reaching into the past for help. Clinton Obama summit to Radio City for a star-studded fundraiser, but where they're not going is key.
Number one.
It's directed at the city council, who seems to believe that criminals in today's day and age should be considered to be the victims of crimes. They're not doing the work of the people, which is what they were voted in to do.
That's the head of the Police Sergeants Association. Now, what is his message? Stay home. That is his message for the police union head to lawmakers who have been anti-cop when it comes to showing up for the wake of Officer Jonathan Diller, gunned down in Queens by a career criminal. As President Trump plans on attending the service for the 31-year-old who has left a young wife and a one-year-old. That's my town, Massapequa Park. He was killed in Queens, where President Trump grew up. He called 2 days ago, at which time, you know, he called the funeral home, and his wife said, I don't want to take any calls. And he says, I think you should take this one. And it was President Trump. He just said, listen, I understand Long Island. I know what police officers do on a daily basis, and I cannot, but I just want to express my sorrow for your loss. They had a long conversation, at which time she said, I'd love for you to come to the wake. Funeral's on Saturday. So Donald Trump's going to be landing on Long Island, and he's going to be going to the wake and then leaving from Florida. From Florida. Guess who's not going? President Biden. Guess who's not even going to the subway system station where a young man, 51 years old, was tossed onto the subway tracks by some deranged lunatic. That happened on the same day of this shooting. He's going to be going hanging out with celebrities, which he could do. But my goodness, could you ever do the right thing as president? I think that would be absolutely the right thing. Let's bring in Mark Thiessen. Mark, how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, good for President Trump for going. And, you know, he has this side of him that I have seen up close that is so charming, so caring, so personal. And he's got to show that to the American people this year. You know, it's almost like he almost hides it because he thinks it won't, like, his base won't appreciate it. It's sort of strange. Like, I had him on my podcast before the 2020 election with my co-host Danny Pletka, who didn't vote for him in the first time around and was considering voting him for the second time. And he was so gracious and so charming, and so that. And she said afterwards, if we saw this Donald Trump every day, he would win in a landslide. And this is, you know, he's got to appeal to people like her. He's got to appeal to people like that who like his policies, don't like Biden, but are really concerned about him and how he presents himself and some of the things he says and they don't like. He's just got to make an appeal to them, because this election is going to be decided. Karl Rove just had a great column in the Wall Street Journal laying out of this. This election is going to be decided in 7 states, and it'll probably be 3 or 4 of those states that decide who wins it, right? And in the 2020 election, it was decided by 43,000 voters in 3 of those states. If 43,000 people had flipped, Donald Trump would have been president again. And so he's got to make it. His base loves him. They're going to vote for him. They're energized. They can't stand Biden. They want him. But he's got to appeal to those folks and show this side of him, who's a good person.
Who loves cops, and they appreciate him.
And loves cops.
So
yeah.
Mark, I've always been in politics like you from a very young age, but I always kept it to myself because I go, there's nobody my age that likes politics. But I'm amazed in Massapequa on Sunday, I look up and there's a bunch of lights on. And I'm thinking to myself, what's going on? And then all of a sudden the flags come out and I see 100 cars go down the road for Donald Trump. I mean, Trump's not here. His son's not here. There's nobody here. They just do it. I mean, they have boat parades in Florida and in Long Island. We've never seen anything like this. So there's really hot beds and really cold beds. And he's got to defrost some cold beds, but the hot beds have never been stronger. And he's going to get he's going to get a big reception today. I know it's not about applause. I'm going to interview him, and it's not going to be at the event. It's going to be somewhere else because they don't. He doesn't think it's appropriate. And I said, I get it, and I understand it.
Yeah, it's look, 100%. He should do it separately, but and he's doing it because he actually cares about cops. Because he actually cares about the people who risk their lives to protect us on the streets every day. That's why he's going. It's not for campaign purposes, but it has it also shows American people that side of him. And this is the reality. The MAGA vote is not. There's not enough MAGA voters in America to win the presidency. He's got to have them. You got to have your base energized. But you also, what successful two-term presidents have always done throughout our history is they've appealed. They've not just fed their base. They've expanded their base. They've gone. They've won over people in their re-election who didn't vote for them in their first election because their policies made them better. And look, the fact is, Donald Trump. You ask most Americans today, were you better off under Trump than you are under Biden? And it's like, you know, it's even people who support Biden would have to admit that they were better off. Most of them, you know, there was the Gallup poll before the 2020 election in October. 56% said they were better off than they were 4 years ago. That was the highest number in the Gallup poll ever, right? But Donald Trump didn't win 56% of the vote. Those are all gettable voters.
Yeah,
people whose lives are better because of his policies. But you know, I remember. I'll tell you a story if we have time. During the 2004 campaign. When Bush was running for re-election, there was polling that said, you know, the people liked a lot of what he was doing, but they didn't. They thought he was a little gruff, a little bit, that they didn't like. So during his convention speech, he did something interesting. He said, you know, I know some of you don't like think I have a certain swagger. In Texas, we call that walking. And I know you all think I'm a little bit blunt. For that, you can thank the white-haired lady sitting up there. But I've always put your interests ahead. Always fought for you, regardless of what you think of me. Trump's got to do something similar. He's got to say a version of that. You know. I know some of you don't like the way I talk. I'm a New Yorker. We're pretty blunt. You know, and some version of that that just acknowledges to people the reasons why he gets it, that he understands why
it's like what Biden's trying to do at his age.
Yeah, exactly. Except, you know, the reason Biden can't fix that problem, the way Ronald Reagan was able to fix it with a joke, is because it's not morning in America again. That whole Reagan line would have never worked if the country would have had the worst inflation in 40 years, the worst crime wave, the worst border crisis. You know, if our borders were secure and the world was at peace and the economy was humming, he could make it. No one would care about his age. But what Trump's problems are fixable with just a wink and a nod to the American people that I get it. I understand why you don't like me, but your life will be better if I'm president. He's got to get that message across and win over. And I don't see him trying. I don't see him trying. And it worries me because, you know what? As bad as Biden is, he can win. He can win. We got too many people on the right pocketing a presidential victory already. And it's not there.
I actually don't know any people at your level that think that. If the Biden people think that they have won and some people say there's no way Donald Trump will get elected, I'm like, well, they're clueless. But anybody can make a case for either one. I mean, it's closing a little bit in some battleground states and some of the polls.
It's going to tighten before the election.
Right.
And when you present one thing the voters have been clear about is they didn't want this rematch and they got it now. Right. And so you're asking a lot of people to choose between two people they don't want. Right. And so that could go either way. You know, it really can. It depends on what they're feeling on the day of the election, because a lot of people are torn by this election because they didn't want to make this choice. They wanted to have different choices. So,
but what you just got to do, know what you have to choose from, since it would be different that they're both moderate. Like, well, who do I like? You know, who do I hate the least? But they're so different. The country will be so different under both of them. Just say, what's the country that you want?
A benign alternative.
Yeah. So I want you to hear what Karl Rove said about RFK. Cut 11.
Well, they should worry. In 2016, third-party candidates got 5.8% of the vote. That's one out of every 17 voters cast a ballot for a third-party candidate. And in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, the Green Party candidate got more votes than Hillary Clinton lost those states by. In 2020, 1.9%, one out of every 50 voters, voted for a third-party candidate. And in Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin, the Libertarian candidate got more votes than Donald Trump lost those states by. So even if they get a very small fraction of the vote, if it's in the right places, it can cause enormous harm.
And he went on to say that RFK, especially with this vice presidential pick, will take more from Democrats. Do you believe that, Mark Thiessen?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's an element of the right that likes him because he's a vaccine skeptic, because he sort of because the Democrats are angry at him. There's an element of conservatives that might like him. But yeah, I think, look, he's the biggest. Kennedy is the biggest name in this Democratic royalty. To have a Kennedy on the ballot is not Biden's dream. I think it probably cuts towards Trump. But, you know, if the polls I've seen show, you know, a marginal, it showed taking from both of them. When you throw a Kennedy on, you know, the Trump leads by one or two or something like that in some of these states. It just depends. And also, he's not going to be on the ballot in every state. He's, you know, one of the things that, you know, no labels, which has literally hundreds of millions of dollars at its disposal, but doesn't seem to have a candidate. But they're on the ballot in 19 states. And that's with all that money. They've so far only been able to secure 19 states ballot access. They were planning to be on all 50 ballots, and I don't think they're going to be. I don't think RFK is going to be on 19 ballots. So, you know, he truly is a spoiler because you can't win the presidency that way.
I watched him yesterday. He says he agrees with 80% of the Libertarian platform. My sense is he's plowing the field to possibly jump there because, as Mark Thiessen knows, they're on all 50 states.
Oh, there you go. That would have to be he'd have to do something like that, or else he can't he can't compete. So, yeah. But I mean, again, like, look at who he picked for his vice president. I mean, who is this woman? She's the ex-wife of the founder of Google. She's a lawyer in Silicon Valley. I mean, it's disqualifying. The idea that, you know, when you pick the vice president, that person is, if you're assuming you're going to win, that person's a heartbeat away from the presidency. You know, I just don't understand his vice presidential choice either.
See, when I saw her as left wing, if he had picked somebody that was a Republican and just an anti-Trumper or something,
yeah,
then I said to myself, he really, you know, he wants to win it. And he wants to, you know, he feels as though he could go right up the middle.
He should have done what No Labels was going to do, or still may, which is to form a bipartisan unity centrist ticket, right? He would have picked a Republican to be on the ballot with him. He's a Democratic, you know, historically Democratic person to present like a centrist bipartisan ticket, but doesn't seem like he's willing to do that.
When you look at the Senate, abortion or not, do you believe that places like West Virginia, Montana, and now Maryland are likely to flip?
God bless Hogan, you know, for getting in that race and not running on a No Labels ticket. They put Maryland in play, which means they're going to have to spend a lot of money there. And he's leading in Maryland, so it can flip. I think we're going to win West Virginia. But, you know, there's other states where it's not clear. The reality is that the stakes have never been higher in the United States Senate and in this election, quite frankly, because next, if we don't take the Senate, first of all, there's no vulnerable Democratic seats for two cycles. So if we don't take the Senate this time, if the Democrats will hold it for a decade, number one. Number two, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are not going to be there next year, which means if the Democrats have the Senate and they have the White House, they're going to get rid of the filibuster and they're going to pass. They're going to add D.C. and Puerto Rico as states. They're going to pack the Senate. They're going to pack the Senate. They're going to pack the Supreme Court, and they're going to pass everything they want with 50 votes. It's going to fundamentally change our country in an irreparable way. So we cannot screw this up.
Right.
This is you know, red alert. Our country is lost if the Democrats take the Senate this time around, and then they also win the presidency.
Spelled it out perfectly. I do think that Tim Sheehy is extremely strong, extremely competent, and what a background. I think people just point out what John Tester has done, and that's nothing. You know, and Dave McCormick, I just had him on. He's trailing by four, and he looks like a candidate that is capable of being Casey, but he's got to expose him for the guy who's pretending to be a moderate, who isn't. So these guys who say they're moderate and never take the risk that Manchin took and Sinema took, I have no patience for.
No.
Final thought?
Can I tell you? My favorite Democrat now is John Fetterman. I apologize for everything I said about him.
Right. He's very intriguing.
I would love Fetterman the way I do.
I'm wearing a hoodie in honor of him. Thanks so much. And I didn't shave. And I probably won't shower in honor of John Fetterman. Thanks so much, Mark Thiessen.
Good luck. And shave your head, too.
Right. If you don't mind, one of these days I'd like to be in your podcast. Allison, just remind me how many times I've thought I was going to be on and I wasn't. She said 12. Okay. Thanks, Mark Thiessen. Back in a moment.
Take care. Bye.
Hi. Good night, everybody.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. We've got a couple of minutes here. Just a quick reminder, April 27th, I want to see everyone in Henderson, Nevada. History, Liberty, and Laughs is going to announce a couple more shows pretty soon. So hopefully we'll be coming to a place near you and get a chance to see all the listeners in person. So it's always, I always love it. So we'll talk about Teddy and Booker T, two American icons, blaze a path to racial equality. That's where we're heading. And the President of Freedom Fighters, Sam Houston, the Alamo Avengers, Andrew Jackson, the Miracle of New Orleans, Thomas Jefferson, and the Tripoli Pirates, and, you know, George Washington's Secret Six. Some of the things we'll talk about, great moments in our history. I think we've got to reorient ourselves to the roots of the country. Do you know it didn't take them long in the Washington Post? You know, that what happened with the tragic plane bridge collapse? Francis Scott Key. They named the bridge after him. That was roughly where the boat was, the British boat was, when he was there trying to get one of his friends out as a hostage, where he was kept there because they were bombing Fort McHenry. At which time he took out his pen and paper and saw the bombs bursting in air and wrote what we now know as the national anthem. Now they're talking about, well, it shouldn't have been named after him anyway because he had slaves. Here we go again. A guy that did so much for our country, basically one of the founding fathers, and that's what they go back to.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Leading economists aren't making much fun of Bidenomics anymore. They're thinking maybe it works to build from the middle out and the bottom up.
It is clear that President Biden's economic plan is working to grow the middle class, spur investments in manufacturing.
Turning to Bidenomics, we start from a position of strength. The U.S. economy is in solid shape.
Bidenomics, which is the word of the day, word of the week, word of the month, word of the year here at the White House.
So Bidenomics is not a word that the White House uses anymore. Last year, summer, they spent $40 million because they thought the numbers were strong. And on the surface, you look at unemployment, you look at GDP, you look at growth, and you say, okay, stock market looks good, let's do it. And it's not working. Where other times people say, you know, they feel a little bit better about the country, even if the numbers aren't as strong as these apparently look. The one thing we don't look at is the debt, and we're paying more in the debt service with the interest rate these high than we are for the entire Defense Department. And we're only raising defense maybe 1% or 2%, which is relatively scary and leaves us way too vulnerable. But that President Biden, if he's going to close the gap, it's not going to be with the economy. He is, according to the recent polls, is treading water without the American people and grading way below Donald Trump and who is better on the economy. So joining us now is Julian Epstein. He serves as chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee and staff director for the House Oversight Committee for the Democratic Party, 96 to 2001. Julian, welcome back.
Brian, thanks for having me. Good to be back with you.
Hey, Julian, a couple of things. I love the column you wrote about what's going on at the border because you take on what Texas did with SB 4. Now, we know and we watched almost a week ago today. A week ago today, we watched the National Guard being overwhelmed by illegal immigrants who just ran over them in an effort to get into our country and get to the next fence. And all of them were let in. Nine have been charged with assault. But this is all part of the chaos of SB 4, where Texas can arrest you if you come here illegally, and the only way to get out of jail is to leave the country. And SB 4 has been held up in the court system. Where do you stand?
Well, yeah, we have that overrunning of the border agents, and you know, today New York is starting a program to give illegal migrants credit cards, debit cards. So this system, I mean, you could take any one of, you know, 20 clips that we've seen in the last month and conclude from that that the system is completely out of control and we have, you know, we have beyond chaos. We have a catastrophe here. This is a catastrophe that is completely of the making of the Biden administration. Biden has the ability to close the border under Section 1182. It's been validated by the Supreme Court. We've seen somewhere between 8 and 10 million illegal crossings under his presidency. The system doesn't have the capacity to handle it. When you consider just the inability of 8 to 10 million unassimilated migrants being able to integrate into the system in any meaningful way. Look at what's happening in Europe. It's been a disaster in Europe. There's footage today in Paris of migrants storming law enforcement because they're deporting illegal migrants there. I mean, this is chaotic throughout the entire West. It's something that Biden could fix immediately with a stroke of a pen. And for political reasons, I think they refuse to. They are cowering to the far progressive intersectional left, who believes that in a demented illogic, believes that enforcing immigration laws is racist. And this is where, you know, the left has really gone off the deep end. In the Fifth Circuit case, Brian, you and I spoke about this a couple months ago. What the Fifth Circuit did yesterday was to extend the stay of the lower court so that SB 4, which allows Texas to enforce the law on its own, is put on hold, at least mm-hmm. until the case is tried on its merits. My guess is this will make it to the Supreme Court. There are really two issues that the Supreme Court will cover, will address. One is whether Texas' argument that this is an invasion, whether that's valid, and if it is an invasion under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, I think it is, the Texas has the right to fend off an invasion. So that's the first issue. I'm not sure that Texas will win on that. I'm skeptical that Texas will win on that issue. But there is a second issue that I think Texas has a better chance of prevailing on, which is in the 2012 case, the Arizona case, which you and I also covered, I think, in our last conversation. Justice Scalia wrote the dissent. That was a case in which Arizona sought to enforce immigration laws and work permitting through its own local authorities. And the Supreme Court struck down that Arizona statute, saying that enforcement of federal immigration laws was the providence of the federal government. Scalia had a very important dissent in that opinion where he said, so long as the state isn't changing the federal law, but merely supplementing the enforcement of it, then that doesn't offend the Constitution. And so the question there, I think, is whether Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Comey will agree with that. And I think that's an open issue when it gets to the Supreme.
But Julian, so I love that. You know, I love when you write in a way in which I can understand the law and the approaches and the strategy. But you talk about what Scalia said in the dissent. He said, look, if their policies back up federal policy, what's the problem? And right. And in this case, it is doing what the federal government should be doing, and that's enforcing the laws that are on the books. And they're so frustrated after 8 million people come in, and they're saying, I've had it. So it's your problem that these policies don't line up, because Texas lines up with how the law is written. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree that this is a disaster, and this – and something has to be done. I mean, this is a perfect example of elite disconnect, that elites think that, you know, elites in Washington think that 8 or 10 million migrants isn't any big deal. We're, you know, give me, you're tired, you're poor, you're hurt of masses kind of a thing. This sort of really idealized version of immigration in a world in which they don't have to live. You notice when migrants are sent up to Martha's Vineyard or into New York, that's when the liberals start to freak out. So what, you know, I think Scalia's argument has some possibility of succeeding. More importantly, this is not just a disaster for the country. This is a disaster for Biden politically. 70 to 80% of his voters 70 to 80% of voters think that Biden has done an abysmal job on immigration and want to see the laws enforced. If you look at black and brown working class voters, they are abandoning the party in droves. They know immigration is driving down their wages. So what I propose in the article in the New York Post piece, Brian, is that the administration ought to be sitting down with Governor Abbott.
Yeah, of course.
And ought to be saying, yes, we recognize this
not.
Is the problem. This
it's
is
not.
A problem that the this is a problem that border states are bearing almost entirely. And this is just, you know, unbelievable. Do as I say, not
but,
as I
but
do.
But, Julian, I have to amend what you said. This is the first time they're not doing it all themselves. They're being bused to these cities, so it's now a nationwide problem. And they can't ignore it, but they want to blame it. I do want to get your take on the move right now to push Fannie Willis off this case. The judge is listening to that argument. Who do you think will prevail here, judging by the judge's decision last time to say Nathan Wade had to go?
Well, I think if Fannie Willis had any real interest in this case, she would resign or recuse herself from it. This is an utter embarrassment. This looks to me, in my opinion, this was a kickback scheme where she hired a boyfriend who was then providing her all kinds of benefits. I think the whole claim about the reimbursements is hard to believe. I think the claims about when the relationship began, I think those are very hard to believe. I think the judge was right to allow the Trump team to appeal. And I think there's not just the question about whether she should be kicked off the case. I think there's a question potentially about perjury moving forward that the state could take up, the legislature is going to look into. So I think there is, I mean, just the, you know, the standard in Georgia is a conflict or the appearance of a conflict. And given that there is a strong appearance that Fannie Willis had an economic incentive for the case to move forward. I mean, I don't know how you argue this is not an appearance of a conflict.
Julian,
in any case, this is an utter embarrassment for the, you know, amongst many other embarrassments for the lawfare crowd that is, you know, prosecuting Trump in the 11th hour of this campaign.
Julian Epstein, thanks so much for being fair and balanced. Appreciate it. Julian Epstein,
Brian,
thank you.
Thanks for having me again.
You got it.
So, bye.
So Commissioner Pat Ryder is Nassau County Police Commissioner, and he knows there's going to be over 100,000 police officers out paying tribute to the slain officer from Massapequa Park. He's going to be joining us shortly and talk about what's going to be happening. One event is for certain. This afternoon, former President Trump will be there. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. More with that in just a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You know what? I have a lot of pride in what it is that I do, and I think every other police officer does. It's difficult when you have other people, especially the politicians, that don't feel the same way and are against you, that do nothing but vilify you. I mean, this is about the kids. This is about our children. It's about our families. We send them off to work or off to school every single day, and we expect them to come home. You know, this is... We don't need these politicians to turn the laws against us. And what they're doing is they're kind of like degrading what society is right now.
So that was head of the SBA, the Sergeants Benevolent Association. That's the president. And he just says, listen, if you're not going to support the cops all year long, I don't want you showing up, taking a bow at their funeral. A guy that might understand that and might not is Commissioner Pat Ryder of Nassau County, where Massapequa Park is located, if you're listening around the country. And that is where the 31-year-old officer lost his that's where he lived before he lost his life over the weekend. Commissioner, welcome back. Of course, we're talking about Jonathan Diller and your thoughts about what he said.
Well, Brian, first of all, thank you for having me. And I 100% agree with him. Don't. Be the fair weather fan, as we call it, right? You're going to come out and you're going to act like you support the men and women of law enforcement. I am sure there's not a politician in this world that wants to see somebody die in the line of duty. That I agree on. But I will tell you this. They want to come out and not make the laws that don't support us. They make the laws that endanger us. They make the laws that don't no longer protects the victims. You know, the victim that is out there, the people on the street, that our citizens that pay taxes and vote are out there, and they're the ones that these laws are affecting. But you're protecting these criminals and giving them more rights. So, yes, to the politicians who write these laws and don't want to stand with the men and women of law enforcement, don't show up. Don't be there and take a bow like you're there and you actually – and I don't want to say care, because I'm sure there is care there. Mm-hmm. But don't act like you're the supporter of law enforcement. You're not. You should – if you support me, change the laws.
The city council, and we know the people in Albany, including Carl Hastie, they just say – they say punishment – does not deter bad behavior. So I don't understand that line of thought. At the very least, it takes them off the streets, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Our jail, you know, there was a point where we probably were putting too many people in the jail for low drug offenses. That's different. You know, when a rich kid can get out on bail over a poor kid, that's different. That's where the law was supposed to change. But they swung the pendulum so far in the other direction that now that when you lock somebody up with a gun, he gets out. When you lock somebody up that breaks into your house, he gets out. They look at it, there's no violence, then we should not hold them and we should not require bail. When do we wait for the violent act to occur? If that guy with that gun never gets stopped or gets stopped and we recover the gun and had committed no act of violence, I get it. But where was he going with the gun? What was he supposed to be doing with that gun? Why are you carrying that gun that you shouldn't be carrying? Because you're a criminal, and criminals don't wait. They'll take the opportunity, commit the crime, and then we get the victims that lose.
Right, and what you're talking about, too, so if I go in and I just rob a Kohl's department store, that's a nonviolent crime. I'm getting out without bail.
That's correct. You go in and you shoplift and you steal $5,000 worth of stuff. You walk out the door, no bail. You get an appearance ticket. If you go in there and you push the security guard as you're walking out, that makes it a robbery. You're going to go to the court and they're going to release you at the court after arraignment with no bail. These
right.
people have – and these are our quality of Good. Life things. This is why nobody wants to go shopping no more. So who's supporting our – the commerce and trying
retail.
To keep the retail stores going out there and selling. We got to stand up for these people. They're the victims. They pay the taxes.
So, Commissioner, tell everybody around the country what it's been like, the salute to the life of Jonathan Diller.
Last night we had the vigil, and the county executive, Bruce Blakeman, and Joe Saladino, the supervisor, they did not get political. They got out there, and they did a beautiful vigil. Commissioner Caban was there. I sat next to him. What a humble guy. So upset about what has happened to his offices. And, you know, we all came together, united. An entire community in Massapequa Park came out in the thousands and lit candles in honor of him and his family. We always we have that motto that we will never forget. We'll always take care of our own. This is when we unite in law enforcement. You will see thousands of people flood that area starting today and tomorrow, and then again on the funeral on Saturday, to make sure that we tell the loved ones, your husband was a hero, he died a hero, we're going to stand by our heroes.
So we know that last year 43 cops died in the line of duty. This year we've got 9 shot already. 2022 was at 55 and 51. Do you worry not only the people, the officers that get shot, the lack of respect on the street?
The lack of respect and the fear that's in my offices on how they react, because they're being judged constantly and overjudged. Right? So you have your normal internal affairs records. Then you have your district attorneys. Then you have the attorney general. Then you have your civil rights violations. And I get it. Look at it. Make sure I'm good. But if I'm afraid to take actions now because I'm afraid I'm going to be judged by the same people who will never walk in my shoes. They don't want to do my job, but they want to judge me on the job that I do. And our cops are now in fear of how they react and respond to some of these things, putting us in jeopardy, because they know if I do this, I might get judged by some guy sitting behind a table who's never done a stitch of work in his life, telling me now that I'm wrong.
People coming from out of town to be here today? It's not just NYPD and Nassau and Suffolk. They're coming from everywhere?
I know already we have response from, you know, they bring the cantinas out there from all the different agencies, and Texas is coming, you know, so that tells you how far this is outreach.
President of the United States, him showing up, does that mean a lot to the family?
100%. When there's nothing more humbling, you know, probably the proudest moment you get as law enforcement, and it's probably the worst time to get that, is at a funeral. You stand there and you look to the left and you right, and you can go look for miles in each direction, and they're lined up, and motorcycles from all over the country, and the flyover by the aviation bureaus. And you sit there and you go, you know what? This is a proud day to be a cop. Not the way I want to be it, but it's a proud day to be a cop.
Commissioner Pat Ryder, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Diagonally from where I'm at right now, you will see Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, President Biden, Stephen Colbert. You'll see them all in person for $100,000. You'll get a picture. They're going to make $25 million. That is insane. Now, they're making a lot of money. Joe Biden's got to feel good about his fundraising. But his poll numbers are not making anyone in the Democratic Party anything but nervous. With his decision not to go to the funeral, to the wake, call the family of the slain officer, Jonathan Diller, to me, it's a layup. You go call. You care. I don't care who you voted for. I know you're from Massapequa. I know it's pretty much a red area. So what? I appreciate your service. You're in the NYPD. You get gunned down. You have a one-year-old. Make the call. But they're leaving for New York, but they're not leaving. They're leaving at, I guess, the motorcade goes to Andrews Air Base in 20 minutes. Air Force One departs in about 30 minutes. Wheels down in New York, 12:35. Plenty of time to get to the first service. You know, you might bump into President Trump, but so what? Or you make the call on the way. I don't know quite where the Democratic Party is, but they're all into diversity. They're into showing that they're united. They're turning on Israel. I thought that Bill Maher nailed it on his monologue on Friday night on HBO. Obviously, a liberal, does not want Trump elected. But when he talks about what the country needs to go, I thought this put it best. And this is the speech that Joe Biden should give, and Joe Biden would win. Cut 15.
The liberal group MoveOn.org, formed in 1998 to urge Republicans to move on from the Clinton impeachment. Today's Democrats should move on from identity politics. It's not working. It's not working for them or for us. Democrats are hemorrhaging the very voters they think they're pandering to. The Financial Times writes, Democrats are going backwards faster with voters of color than any other demographic, and suggests the reason is that a less racially divided America is an America where people vote more based on their beliefs than their identity. Exactly. Far left liberals are living in an old paradigm. Americans don't fit into neat little boxes anymore. Who has the number one country song right now? Beyonce.
And he goes on. Everything's blended. And instead, unless people are really intent on dividing us, and a lot of it has to do with outside sources like North Korea hacking, Chinese through TikTok and other means, and Russia, they find out what divides us and they start amplifying that element of it. Democratic Party, Republican Party, don't do it. And I say one thing about Republicans. They're not looking to divide you. They want everybody they possibly can. They don't pander to communities, maybe sometimes to their detriment. But the one thing that's happening, President Trump, 22% of the black vote, last poll that was taken. If he gets close to that, he wins. And he gets the majority of the Hispanic vote now. I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. I didn't. They told us it was going the other direction. But they tell us a lot of things. So I'll be next time you I'll be tomorrow. I'll have an interview with President Trump, gets his perspective. Here's some cuts from President Biden tonight with Obama and Clinton. It's going to be an exciting 6 to 7 months. Let's see who survives. When we come back, a special guest, Jonathan Haidt.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. It's my privilege to bring in best-selling author, brand new book out, Jonathan Haidt, brand new book is called The Anxious Generation. Everybody is talking about it, and you all can relate to it, how the great rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. And we're not looking back 100 years, Jonathan. I feel like we're in the middle of this, and we're trying to stop this tornado in the middle of the tornado.
Absolutely.
What alerted you to the link between the cell phone, the iPhone, and anxiousness?
So I'm a college professor. I teach at New York University Stern School of Business. And many of us who teach on college campuses, we noticed something going very wrong around 2014, 2015. And that led me to write an article and then a book with my friend Greg Lukianoff called The Coddling of the American Mind.
He's been on.
Yeah. Oh, good, good. And, you know, at the time we thought colleges were somehow making kids sick by teaching them bad ideas. But a few years later, we discovered, no, actually, it's everyone born after 1995. I mean, not literally everyone, but the generation born after 1995. Their rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm, and suicide are much, much higher, 50 to 100% higher than for the millennials. So that's – seeing that led me to start asking, what happened? Why is this happening so sharply around 2012, 2013 it begins? And why is it happening in multiple countries? That's what the book is about.
Right. So, and you came to the conclusion that it was the advent of?
Well, it was not the advent of the smartphone itself. The smartphone itself, I remember when I got my first one in 2008, it was an amazing, like, digital Swiss Army knife. It had all these great tools. It was a tool that I could pull out of my pocket if I wanted something. But then in 2008, you get the App Store. 2008 or 9, you get push notifications. And pretty soon, by 2010 or so, 2011, you've got 100 or 1,000 companies on your phone trying to interrupt you, trying to pull you over to them. So now it's not a tool. It becomes more of a master. And look, every adult here knows what I'm talking about. It's hard for us to stay focused. Imagine you're 11 or 12 years old. You don't have a developed prefrontal cortex. It's hard for you to stay on task. And you have this thing in your pocket constantly saying, hey, you want to know what someone just said about you? Click here. So it was really that transformation between 2010 and 2015, a huge transformation in children's lives. That, I think, is what set them up for anxiety, depression, and mental illness.
And you also don't solely blame the iPhone, right?
No, that's right. There's two
There's
parts.
More to it. That's what I think is so intriguing.
Oh, thank you. Yes. People tend to focus on the phones because that's what we're all – I mean, we're all in the midst of it. But there's a longer backstory, and thanks for giving me the invitation to tell that. In The Coddling of the American Mind, Greg and I talked about how kids used to have free play. You and I think we're about the same age. I was born in 1963. We grew up during a big crime wave. There was some danger out there. But all kids went out to play. It would have been totally unnatural for parents to say, no, you stay inside. You know, 8 year old, you're not allowed outside. We all went out to play. And that's how you learn basic social skills. That's how you get tougher. That's how you learn to manage risk. And Americans kind of stopped that in the 1990s. We freaked out about child abduction, a few other risks. And we basically took away normal human childhood. Now, at first, the kids didn't get mentally ill. We took them inside. They started playing on computers. They're not as tough anymore, but they're not yet depressed and anxious. It's only then when we get to around 2010 to 2015, it's in that period that the kids go from having flip phones, because all the millennials had flip phones, which they could text each other or they could call. That's okay. They go to having a smartphone with high-speed internet and unlimited data plan and Instagram, and a front-facing camera. So especially for girls, by the time you get to 2015, you're a 12-year-old. Your life is all about taking photos of yourself and comparing yourself to others like thousands of times a day. And this just, you know, this is just an inhumane way to raise children.
So this week also, Ron DeSantis took a move, made a move in Florida, and he is banning all cell phone use for
kids. Not cell phone use, social media use.
Social media use is a big difference. Cut one.
The way this bill is structured, it is not engaging in any regulation of speech. It is basically identifying functionality, you know, that is causing harms, the addictive features. And so that's laid out in the bill. We worked hard with the legislature because at the end of the day, you know, we're not just here spinning our wheels. We're not just trying to get a photo. We want something that actually sticks and actually has a positive impact.
And he's looking to keep it below 16.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and that's exactly the right way to go. I'm thrilled with the Florida bill. It's excellent. In my book, I recommend four norms that if we do them, we can really roll this back. One of them is no smartphone till high school, but the second one is no social media until 16. And the reason is because puberty is a really, really special time. People don't fully understand I don't think people really appreciate just how fast a child's brain is rewiring itself from around age 11 or 12 when puberty starts to around 15, 16. Puberty goes on longer than that, but the early years of puberty are the most vulnerable years. And there's research showing that girls are most damaged by social media between the ages of 11 to 13. Boys might be a little bit later, 14 to 15. And so the idea that American children, children all over the world, during the most sensitive years in which their brain, their frontal cortex is trying to wire up to, you know, how do we live in this culture? Who am I? All those questions that they're working out in early adolescence. To have those guided by random weirdos on the internet that are chosen by algorithms because of how extreme they are, this is insanity. And so for DeSantis to say, look, let's just hold it back till 16, I think is perfect.
And different states are doing that or trying, and I want to talk about the implementation of it. Jonathan Haidt is here. He's with a Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Studies at NYU and Stern School of Business, and best-selling author of, you know, The Coddling of the American Mind, co-author there. But his book is called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. So I have a childhood. I'm in my house. When I walk out of that house, my life is unscripted, whether I'm going to the food store, running errands, or whatever it is. I'm hopping on that bike. I could run into people that could negatively influence me. Is that the same thing you're saying this happens on social media, only to the millionth power?
No, it's very, very different. So, humans are mammals. We're very similar to other primates, where we have a lot of similarity to dogs and cats. Mammals need to play. They need to play physically. It's especially clear for boys. Boys need a lot of rough and tumble play, wrestling, running around. All kids do. And that's what our brains are kind of expecting. And we need to develop our social skills one-on-one or in small groups. You say something, your friend makes fun of you, you're a little embarrassed, and then it's over. You move on. So that's the way – that's a healthy childhood. You have to make a lot of mistakes, and they have to be low-cost mistakes. We all made thousands of low-cost mistakes, and we learned from them. Now what happens when kids move their social lives onto, let's say, Instagram or Facebook or any of those other platforms? Now you say one false word, you make one mistake. It could blow up to an infinite scale. It could be that everyone at your school is making fun of you. It could even go national. So the mistakes are no longer low-cost. Also, when we were hanging out with our friends, joking around, teasing each other, we were playing. We were having fun. We weren't managing our brand. But when you're online and you're always thinking, should I post this? Should I like this? What should I say? It's not what you really feel. It's what will people think if I do this versus that? And so we're turning our 11-year-olds into brand managers. And again, that's just a twisted way to develop. It's interfering with normal human development.
And you know what I think too is people like, I'll compete. You want me to compete? I'll compete. But I'd rather not even go into the social media world. But if I have to, I'll do it. But I'm only not going to do it if I know I'm not missing out. That's part of it. And not missing out would be finding out that if that kid is on social media at 11, 12, they're going against the rules. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to stay out past a curfew, if you want to not do your homework, there's always going to be those people. Mm-hmm. But that you want to put that into society where, my goodness, I saw a 10-year-old on social media. It's so offensive. Mm-hmm. How could those parents do that? Mm-hmm. And you're optimistic that we can do that now.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Because I've been involved in a lot of attempts to change people's minds and message. And I ran a gun control group when I was in college, and we got nowhere. This is entirely different. I don't have to persuade anyone. Every parent I talk to, everyone who has kids, everyone who's a teacher, they all see the problem. I don't have to persuade them that this is a problem. What I have to do is fight their resignation. Wherever I go, parents are like, yeah, you know, this is terrible what's happening. But, you know, what are you going to do? The train's left the station. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. This is the way of the future. But, you know, if the train has left the station full of kids and we know that the train is headed for a bridge that's collapsed and the kids are going to fall to their death – I think we should try to call back the train.
And you know what the good news is? I don't think anyone listening to us right now are thinking, it's fine.
Right.
No problem.
That's right.
There's nobody I know who says no problem.
That's right. Even the kids. You ask Gen Z, they know it's messing them up. And that's why I'm optimistic. Because it's not like, you know, when you and I were kids and our parents probably said, oh, they're watching too much television. It's right in their brains. Let's get them off television. Well, we love television. And if they told us no more television, we would have been very upset. But with social media, over and over again, what we find is if you say to a kid, I'm taking away your social media, they freak out because now they're cut off. They're basically socially dead. But if you offer them the possibility, like what if we took it away from everyone? Would you like that? And over again, in studies, in anecdotes, in talks with my students, they say yes. In fact, there are several studies in which it's been asked, would you rather live in a world where Instagram and TikTok were never invented? And the majority of college students in this one study I recently read said yes.
Some of the things that you've already went over. No smartphones before high school.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. No social media before 16.
Yep.
Phone-free schools.
Yes.
You might, you know, that's tough in a public school situation. You could go find a school like mm-hmm. that, but, I mean, you could get together with PTA mm-hmm. and try to have your voice heard that way mm-hmm. and maybe show examples. And then lastly, more free play and responsibility in the real world.
Yes, those are the four norms.
So it's kind of a, I would like you to do something with no rules. So tell these mm-hmm. kids to go out. Now, yes. in that time, there are going to be kids that are in the cool crowd.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be kids that are in the non-cool crowd. Mm-hmm. And the natural instinct for parents is, I don't want my kid to feel left out.
Right.
But it's important for them to go through those experiences in life
mm-hmm.
because nothing's That's right. permanent.
That's right. That's right. The kids need to be out having adventures with each other. If I just ask you, do you feel when you were young, when you were 8, 9, 10, 13, 14, do you feel you sometimes had adventures with your friends?
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's obvious. Right. Of course we did. That's what we were looking for every day. And how old are your kids, if I may ask?
My kid, 27, 23, and now 21.
Okay, so they're technically all Gen Z, although they're older Gen Z. Do you feel as though your kids had as many adventures when they were young as you did?
Probably not. No. They were big athletes, so they're involved in two or three sports mm-hmm. at a time. So that's one thing, by the way. Makes me more want to do sports than ever.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that is old school.
That's right.
You know, you got the parents too much, yeah. helicopter parents, we got that. Mm-hmm. It's an issue or not, and money is an issue. But I'll take those problems.
Absolutely.
Because – you get to negotiate. How do I handle pressure? How do I handle a coach that yells?
Right.
How do I handle being cut?
Mm-hmm.
All those things get you ready for life. You used to, mm-hmm. okay, if you don't choose sports, you have other things. But now your other thing is in your hand.
That's right. That's right. So what we find, and this is research I've done with my research partner, Zachary Rausch, what we find, we've looked at the data all different ways. We plot it out. You see that the trends were fine in the early 2000s. There's nothing going up, no sign of a problem. Now, all of a sudden, the lines go way up around 2012, 2013 for depression, anxiety, self-harm, all sorts of things. But when we graph it out by religion, that is, kids who said that on a survey, religion is important to me or my family, their lines go up much less. And those who say religion is not important to me or my family, they go up much more.
That's so interesting.
There's also research showing that kids who are active in their church or religious organization and kids who are active in sports, especially team sports, also had a lot of protection. So the way to think about this is kids must be rooted in a community of real people with a moral order, moral structure, a sense of what's good and bad, right and wrong. They need that the way plants need to be rooted in soil.
I know Abigail
Schreier.
Abigail Schreier was here and she said, have intentional, non-directed conversations, small talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's important to have small talk. He goes, because if you have small talk with someone to feel comfortable in non-consequential conversations, when you have to have a real conversation, mm-hmm. it doesn't come out of the blue. I feel comfortable talking to you. Now, let me tell you what just happened in school. I just got rejected. And you fill in the blank. The one thing I think it has done, it's wiped out small talk. So
that
you get in the car. Everyone's mm-hmm. got their phones out. Now, you can tell them to put it away, but they're pretty much waiting. They get texts and they get distracted. Instead of focusing on the people there, well, I have nothing to say. I was with you all day. Mm-hmm. Well, you start traveling around, you look around, oh, it just reminds me. You don't have those unscripted conversations. Jonathan Haidt, guy is fascinating. When we come back, more on him, the book, why he took off the entire summer in order to let everybody know that we have an answer to the anxious generation, his new book, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. You are listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Before we get back to our conversation with Jonathan Haidt of NYU, out with a new book, certainly be a bestseller, The Anxious Generation. Just a quick note, on April 27th, I'm going to be on stage, History, Liberty, and Laughs, BrianKilmeade.com. It's a stage experience that many people say is better than Hamilton. Okay, just me. I think so, but I'm a little biased. We reenact great moments in history in a fun and entertaining way. It's the most unique show you'll ever see. So I'd love to meet you in person, BrianKilmeade.com. Now back to our conversation with Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan wrote this great book, Coming Off the Coddling of the American Mind. He wanted a game plan to give parents to help get back a typical or traditional youth youth experience for this next generation. Here's more as he talks about the need to get aggressive. Did you say, you point to a graph in your book and said, as time has gone on, less visits, less injuries of kids going to be hospitalized or, you know, broken arms, broken fingers, because they're not doing a lot of
anything that could break a bone.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's,
and that's
one of the
bad,
most,
believe it or not, you're saying.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
It means no risk.
That's right. You don't want kids to be having zero broken bones because that means that they're not doing anything. They're not taking any risk. They're not riding bicycles. They're not swinging from ropes. They're not climbing anything. So that's one of my favorite graphs in the book. We have all this data showing that kids are getting more risk averse. Gen Z is more afraid of risk. And that's going to have huge ramifications for the country. They're less likely to start businesses, to take entrepreneurial risks. So we've got all this self-report data that kids are more afraid of risk. And then I found this data set from the CDC where they track hospitalizations all across the country for various reasons. Right. And one thing they track is hospitalizations for fractures, that is broken bones. And what you see is that before 2010, the people who got the most broken bones by far were teenage boys, followed by men in their 20s. Those are the two groups where you got daredevils, they're doing things. They're the ones who break bones. Middle-aged men don't. Women generally don't, much lower rates.
So
until 2010. Once we get into this period, the great rewiring, the rates for boys especially, rates for everyone goes down because all of us are on our phones all the time. But the rate for boys plunges to the point where now a teenage boy is slightly less likely to have a broken bone than his father or grandfather because they're not doing anything that could break a bone. They can't even play with each other after school because if they want to be on video games, they each have to go home alone so they can put on their headset, their controller, their screen, and that's how they can play with each other.
You know what's so interesting too is you mentioned you're in a business school. So you need that entrepreneur. I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to risk it all. I'm going to go up and knock on those doors. Steven Spielberg opens up an office on campus, I think, of Warner Brothers and pretends like he's a producer, ends up being the most successful ever. But those people that take risk, and let alone the Navy SEALs, we obviously need those type of people in this country. Entrepreneurs, if we don't have people out taking risks, that's the thing that separates us from everybody else.
Exactly. That was our brand. That was our secret sauce. It was the people who took risks, willing to take risks. They're the ones who got on the boats and came here. Now, obviously, different groups came here under different circumstances. But it's always been the people who were seeking a better life and were willing to gamble at all were the ones who immigrated here. Risk takers from all over the world. Like in the early days of Silicon Valley and all the way through the 90s and 2000s, it was these people from South Asia and all East Asia, all over the world. They were coming here because we had this open, free environment where you could gamble and you had a good shot of winning if you could work hard. That is at risk of changing.
So what's so interesting is, you know, life became easier. Obviously, we get to the 20th century and 21st century. We end up from walking, from biking. We get cars, we get roads, and we get planes. Everything changes. And we just keep on improving. Now, AI is here. That's another book for you. But you're asking us, in a way, to turn down the option of technology in order to go back to the way it was, which put us on a path of advancement.
For our children especially.
Have we ever done something like this before?
Well, let's see. Have we ever done something like that?
I can't think of any other time where we're asking, you know, we did get a TV and we did hope to have one in every room. Then we got cable and then we have different ways to communicate and advertise and we go everywhere. Now we go to a gym and we go to a dentist and we see the TV. Now I walk into my house, TV's not even on. I mean, it's
right because people the handheld devices are more gripping.
Right. I'm like, you don't want to watch anything. You don't even know when it's on, and they ask a programmer.
But Brian, that's a really good question. Have we ever gone back? So the what you're talking about are sometimes called problems of prosperity or problems of progress. And our technology has made our lives easier, from the invention of fire and plumbing, thank God for those, all the way through the invention of the telephone, the automobile. All these things make our lives easier. Let me just put on the table here a really key psychological term called anti-fragility. It's a term, it refers to the property of systems that are not fragile. They actually, you know, something is fragile, you got to protect it, like glass is fragile, you don't want it to bang around, it'll break. But there are some things that need to bang around. They need to be stressed and challenged in order to develop properly. So bones and muscle are that way. If you take it easy on your muscles, you get weak. If you push them to the point of pain, you get strong. The immune system is that way. If you try to protect your kid from dirt and germs, they're going to have autoimmune diseases. Their immune system won't work. If you expose them to dirt and germs, let them play in the dirt, they'll be healthier. So there's a very important concept. And now to go back to your point, as we've made lives easier and easier for us as adults, we've made it easier and easier for our kids. kids can now get what they want without even getting up from the sofa. They can, they have everything they want on their phone. The boys have pornography. They don't need to pursue girls. Everything is so easy that our kids who are anti-fragile, who need challenges and failures, they need to experience stress and then overcome it and have a sense of victory. Everything is so easy for them that they're not having the experiences that would turn them into men and women.
Right. They're not dating like they
used
to.
That's right.
They're not going up to someone in a bar and having the risk of rejection.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Yeah.
And being prosecuted.
And that I never thought I'd be living a time where we have to urge people to have sex.
Yeah. And drink. I shouldn't say this on the air, but, you know, my kids kind of know that I want them to have adventures.
Right. And so how many kids do you have?
I have two kids, both in high school.
And so have you done this with them? Have you told them, give me your cell phone? Well, they're in high school, so they passed the limit. Did you try to hold it back?
With cell phone, we didn't because I didn't know back then. So we gave my son a cell phone when he started walking to school. So I learned early on from Lenore Skenazy, who's my partner in this. She wrote the book Free Range Kids. I learned that we need to send our kids out. So I'd sent my kids out on errands. And when my son started walking to school in fourth grade, we gave him my old iPhone. If I had it to do again, I'd just give him a flip phone or an Apple Watch. Those seem to work well. So I understand the need to track your kid. But what I did hold the line on is social media. I made it clear, no social media till high school at the earliest. So I did keep my kids off. And my daughter, when she was in sixth grade, she couldn't have Instagram. And when she was in seventh grade, she said to me, Daddy, I'm glad you did that because the Instagram girls are stupid. She could see what it did to them. She could see they were like shallow and stupid and slutty. So I did hold the line there, and I'm still holding it on Snapchat.
As everybody in the control room will know, I am not the most forward-thinking person. The thing I like about social media for me is it tells people what's coming up. I could say that you're coming up on the show, so my followers, so it helps me, hey, I'm going to be on this appearance. But I'm very almost embarrassed to say this, but on Instagram, I could do those TED Talks. Mm-hmm. So I'm on those, and like there'll be four or five different ones popping up, and I'm like, wow, I'm going down a worm, but I'm happy to.
That's right.
I'm happy to. Like, oh, that's an interesting. I never thought of this. I never thought of that. And then also, I'm profiled on YouTube. They know I love history, so I'm getting this instant patent bio as a segue to this battle in World War II. So there can be positives to this where you're expanding your mind. I thought to myself, instead of maybe reading the news, I just expanded my mind in history. Mm-hmm. So there could be a positive to that.
For adults, absolutely. And so first, I always encourage people to remember that social media is not the internet. The internet is amazing. You know, people like you and me, we remember the 90s first encountering it. I mean, it was mind-boggling that you could have access to information all over the world instantly.
I'm doing books and I do not have to go to Washington.
That's right. That's right. So the internet is fantastic. I'm not saying let's ban the internet for kids. Social media is something different. Social media is a tool that – by which companies can use us to gain our attention for advertisers. It's also a tool that we can use for our purposes. I use Twitter to get the word out. I use Twitter to find things. So I have no objection. I understand the value of social media platforms for adults who need to network and get information out. Tell me what 7-year-old needs to network with millions of people or get the word out. My argument is that these tools, which adults can make their own minds about, as with gambling, but we wouldn't say, you know what, let's just let 11-year-olds into casinos. Let's let the companies design special slot machines that appeal to children to take all their money and debit their credit card. Like, that would be insane. But that's kind of what we're doing when we allow any 11-year-old, any 9-year-old can just lie about their age because there's no, you know, the age enforcement is not mandated by Congress.
Right. And to this, to parents listening right now, this is one of those things I think classic is you went into the pool and the water gradually got hotter.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it started boiling, you didn't want to be the first to get out because there were positives to it. And what you're trying to do with this book is saying this is how you get out, and we could all get out together.
We can do it together. That's right. No one wants to be the only one stepping out. But if everyone's uncomfortable and somebody said, hey, folks, what do you say we all get out? That's how we do it. That's why it's so important to have clear norms.
Professor Haidt, just getting started. His book tour brought him to our studio. We were able to talk to him yesterday afternoon. More with Jonathan Haidt when we return. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Do not move. More from the author of The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness and the Game Plan to Fix It.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Yeah, you've heard us talk about the need to get out the iPhone, how disturbing it is, how you never feel like you're off in your life, whether it's social media or whether it's text message, constant communication. But let's focus on the youth, and let's have more with Jonathan Haidt. He's got the new book out, The Anxious Generation. It's really destroying these kids, and it's not their fault. They got caught up in this. We all got gradually caught up in it. The game plan to fix it. Here's more with Professor Haidt.
The four norms that we can all coalesce around, all right. Parents, all schools, we can do these if we do them together. No smartphone before high school. Give them a flip phone or a phone watch. Nothing. It doesn't have a browser on it. That's the key thing. Or social media platforms. The second rule, no social media before 16. Just don't let them open accounts. Don't let them download the app. Mm-hmm. Third rule, phone-free schools. The phone must be locked up in the morning in a phone locker or a yonder pouch. The kids get it back in the afternoon. Otherwise, it's in their pocket distracting them while they're in class, while they're at lunch with each other. They're all paying attention to their phones.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth rule is far more free play, independence, and responsibility in the real world. If we're going to greatly reduce screen use by, say, 50, 70%, we can't just expect them to just sit there and do nothing. We need to let them out to play with each other, to hang out, to have adventures. The world is so much safer than it was when you and I grew up.
And give them chores.
And
right?
Chores, yes, absolutely.
Right? Give them chores. Hey, guys, I need you to go. Someone's got to go to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. I'm going to need X, Y, and Z.
Absolutely. Because one of the things that Gen Z is really suffering from, this comes out very clearly in the surveys, is a pervasive sense of meaninglessness, pointlessness, and uselessness. They agree with a statement on one of the surveys, sometimes I feel my life has no value, or I feel my life has no purpose. Do you agree with that? And very few kids agreed with it before 2010. By 2015, it's about doubled the number who agree with it.
Right. I have an email, a question for you. This is from Arez. So many of our parents don't want our kids to have smartphones, but we don't know where to start. Have you seen any parents or communities successfully aligned to overcome the collective action problem and commit to delaying smartphones and social media access? Is it happening?
It is happening, yes. So religious communities are actually doing great at it. I just spoke to a collection of 50 Jewish day schools. Jewish schools are doing fantastically because Jews already have the Sabbath. They already have one day every week when there are no electronics allowed for Orthodox Jews. So religious communities have a lot more social capital, more trust, more ability to work together. They're doing it. The other thing is there's an organization, Wait Until 8th, which has this great idea that, you know, a bunch of parents, when the kid's in first or second grade, they sign a pledge to wait until 8th grade. And then when they get 50 people in the school, then the pledge is sort of live. And so that's a great way to get out of the collective action problem. The only difficulty is that age, 8th, was picked long ago, not really for a mental development reason. And what I'm arguing is it has to be 9th. It has to be high school because we have to clear this out of middle school. If phones come flooding into 8th graders, that's going to affect the 7th and 6th graders. We've got to – I mean, middle school, we can win. Getting phones out of high school is going to be harder. But elementary and middle school, for God's sakes, get them out. Let the kids pay attention to their teachers and to each other.
You know, my kids saw a social dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And they got ticked off.
Really?
Because they
see
how they're being manipulated.
Oh, good, good, good. Okay.
Right. And they said, well, this is, you know, really aggravating. They know how to hook you in. They know how to mold what you think. Lastly, on TikTok – there's a lot of pushback in Congress. I don't even think they're going to put it up for a vote in the Senate, which is nuts. There's a national security element to
TikTok.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Maybe Professor Haidt, maybe you could tell us why.
So the national security issue is because TikTok is an incredibly influential platform, perhaps the most influential platform on our children's development. The kids are spending more time on it. And what I'm coming to see is the short form video is the most destructive thing possible. Just to give you an example, I do a little thing I did with my students at NYU. I asked, how many of you watch Netflix at least once a week? Almost everybody. How many of you wish Netflix was never invented? Nobody. Nobody. Watching stories is good. Then I say, how many of you use TikTok regularly? Almost everybody. How many of you wish TikTok was never invented? Almost all of them.
Wow.
They see because they see it. They're on. And I say, well, why don't you get off? And they say, well, I have to be on if everyone else is. I have to keep up because people are talking about the latest TikTok thing. I have to be in the know. So it's a collective action problem. One reason I'm so optimistic is that Gen Z is really savvy about this. They're not in denial. They're not fighting us. They're actually beginning to organize. There are a bunch of there's Design It For Us. There's a whole bunch. If listeners go to anxiousgeneration.com, that's the website for my book, we have a page of aligned organizations, a number of which are run by Gen Z founders. So Gen Z is beginning to rise up and say, stop exploiting us. Stop trapping us. We want to have a life.
Exactly. Oh, wow, I love that. And also national security. The Chinese, there's a law that if you have any tech that you have, has to be shared with the country, with the nation.
As I understand it, Chinese law says that every company must do what the Chinese Communist Party tells it. And so when TikTok executives tell us, oh, well, you know, the data for Americans is kept over here in Singapore or whatever it is, and, you know, we don't share. Oh, come on. I mean, there is no way to believe that. So, I'm wary about Congress banning companies. But this is a very special case where our primary geopolitical rival, not enemy, but, you know, our rival, there's possible tensions coming up, controls the most influential platform on our children. As Tristan Harris has pointed out, he made the social dilemma. You know, it's as if in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the Soviet Union controlled PBS and Sesame Street and ABC and NBC. I mean, if they controlled our media that was broadcasting to our kids, we would never have allowed that. And that's sort of the situation now with TikTok.
And, you know, and I'm sure you might have seen some of the bipartisan work on China and the 300-plus votes.
Yes, that's exciting. Yes,
and there have been times where the Chinese government has accessed information and mm-hmm. the CEO has not been candid about that. Yeah. And in the New York, they would not even know in America what's going on.
That's right. No way.
And one of the guys is directly linked to the current communist government of China on the board. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to me, it's not even you know, the people have said, well, it's not fair, have open competition. Not really when it comes to national security. They can't buy Fox. Rupert Murdoch, to have Fox, had to become an American citizen.
Oh, interesting.
And CBS,
oh, wow.
CBS can't be bought. You can have the best company in the world. They cannot. We'll never have
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's great.
You cannot buy a communications network here if you're a Saudi sovereign wealth fund. It's not allowed, right?
That's amazing. That's very important. Thank you for that.
Right. Yeah. No problem. So listen, congratulations on the bestseller. It's called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. Jonathan Haidt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Guys, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope some parents feel some hope from that conversation. Meanwhile, I'm going to have a chance to talk to the President of the United States. I'm going to bring back the interview on Friday's edition of the Brian Kilmeade Show. And it's all about his intention to attend the wake of Jonathan Diller, the 31-year-old police officer who was slain, gunned down by career criminals in Queens, New York. Thanks so much for listening. And by the way, you have been listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show, and I fully support your decision.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.